No more Russian vodkas.
From New York to San Francisco, gay bars.
We say boycott of Russian products and the Sochi Olympics is a worldwide boycott.
Russian
and we hope
vodka
it sends a strong
could soon be
to the
a hunt to find
today
in New
at
York.
The Russian consulate in New York City to let the Putin government and Russian
LGBT Putin face reality.
No Stoli, no Sochi.
LGBT Putin face reality, no Stoli, no Sochi. Vodka boycotts, noisy and colorful demonstrations at Russian embassies, and most recently, high-profile calls for moving the 2014 Winter Olympic Games out of Sochi. These are some of the international reactions to recent laws against so-called homosexual propaganda and to a series of violent attacks on gays in Russia. On several continents, bars are shunning top-shelf vodkas like Russian Standard. At a recent demonstration in Amsterdam, LGBT activists started a new trend by dressing up like Russian Oman riot police. And in a letter to the International Olympic Committee this week, the prominent British television personality Stephen Fry called for the southern Russian resort city of Sochi to be stripped of the right to host the Olympics next year. A letter he also tweeted to his more than 6 million Twitter followers. Holding the Olympics in Sochi, Fry wrote, will be akin to the infamous 1936 games in Berlin in Nazi Germany. Vladimir Putin, he wrote, is making scapegoats of gay people just like Hitler did Jews. Russia's discriminatory laws against gays were enacted for domestic purposes as Putin, having lost the backing of the rising middle class, sought to shore up his support among traditional elements in society. But they are increasingly turning into an international headache for the Kremlin. Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me via Skype from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service and a contributor to the online magazine Politru. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
And also on the all-important Skype line is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of the excellent Sean's Russia blog. Welcome back, Sean.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello. The thing about the LGBT issue that I find pretty consequential is that of all the things dividing Russia and the West today, and they are legion, this one divides not just governments, but societies. It evokes intense passions in society, both in Russia and in the West. And this is all the more interesting given the fact that in much of the West, and certainly in the United States, this issue has moved forward only recently. Only recently have our own societies moved towards anything approaching full equality for our own gay, lesbian, and transgender citizens. You got to remember the landmark 2003 Supreme Court ruling, Lawrence versus Texas, which essentially made same-sex relations legal across the United States. It only happened 10 years ago. Kirill, start with you. I mean, what do you think? Has the West just moved much further and faster on this issue, and Russia's moving slowly, or is Russia just in an entirely different place, and what are the consequences of that?
I think that we can speak about, in this context, about Russia as a, you know, an entire body and so on. We are speaking about some measures of Russian government and of Russian State Duma and the Russian government. Public attitude to the problem of LGBT, all this, you know, problems of LGBT community and so on, is slightly different from which we have seen for, you know, several last months in the State Duma and in Russian government.
Is it, though? That's my question.
Yes. I am trying to explain this. First of all, the result of all these measures of Duma and government and Putin himself, some of his words and so on, is that not he, but himself, but Putin's regime now is feeling a very serious blow from international society because of issue which they conceded before this as a very, you know, unimportant. And that is the result of underestimating of, you know, the whole set or whole collection of universal human rights, which are very important for the Western society, and which are absolutely unimportant for Putin himself and all his circle. And he usually they think about all these things as a, you know, just a rubbish, just a reason, just a thing we can discuss in our connections or discussions with the West. It's not about that they considered seriously, for instance, the rights of LGBT community in Russia. They tried to resolve some domestic problems, or these measures are for just, you know, if I can see, for domestic consumption. Mm-hmm. But they didn't consider the consequences of all these measures as important, as an international, as something, you know, dangerous for the image, seriously dangerous for the image, and so on. And that's my point.
But these measures are in Russia, if I'm not mistaken, popular.
They couldn't be unpopular because of the state of Russian society. But we are speaking not about, you know, the majority of Russian society. We are speaking about professional politicians and the government, which are obliged not to bring any harm to the society. They are considerably bringing the harm to the public, you know, consequence, public mind, bringing all these hateful, rubbish things into it. So that's very important. And they are not, you know, coming along with the, you know, public opinion about LGBT rights and so on. They invented the whole agenda. That's very important. Mm. And they failed playing with this agenda.
Now, it seems to me if they tried to do this 10 years ago, 15 years ago, you wouldn't have had this kind of reaction we're seeing in the West. Sean, let's go to you on this. Do you think Putin just miscalculated where the West is on this issue? Or does he care?
First, I think he doesn't care. You know, when we saw this again, we saw this with the ban on foreign adoptions. I mean, there was a lot of global outcry about this, and they weathered the storm and things continued as they did. So their calculation might be either A, they don't care, or B, they can weather the storm and after everything calms down, things will just continue as they are. But the Russian government couldn't have picked a worse time to enact such a law, if you think of it in the kind of global context, because of the landmark as you said, things have moved so fast in the United States and in Western Europe around gay marriage in particular. And I think it's important to point out when we speak about gay rights in the West, we're mostly speaking about the most recent developments it's gay marriage, which mm-hmm. is a big one, but isn't the complete encompassing of the gay rights movement.
Right.
But back to your original question, I mean, in terms of is Russia on another planet or will they eventually catch up the West? If you agree with kind of a teleology in these kind of rights movements, then Russia maybe is 20 years behind, if one can mm-hmm. say. But I tend not to like these kind of linear right. processes. But I think what's important to focus is that, you know, gay rights, the advancement of gay rights in the West is because of a very intense struggle that has gone on for 30 years.
Yeah.
And Russia has never really is only now developing a gay rights movement, only now, thanks to the Russian government largely. Gays and lesbians are visible in Russian society. I mean, the Russian government kind of conjured gays into existence to some extent.
Right.
Because, I mean, they, as Kirill correctly said, they invented this entire agenda. And the question I have that I don't know if I really have an answer for is why? Why gays of all people? Because they you know, if you want to do percentages, they make up very small percentages of the population. As I said, they weren't incredibly visible in Russian society just because being in the closet at this point isn't the norm. But I think now because of these laws is going to be less of a norm because coming out is going to be a political statement.
Right.
And the only thing I can think of is there's the anti-Westernism of it. I mean in the Soviet period, homosexuality was seen as kind of a bourgeois infection from the West.
And it was illegal.
And it was illegal, of course, but it was seen as, you know, the Bolsheviks saw it as bourgeois decadence, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's some legacy of that in Russian society as something that's being infected upon Russian society. Mm-hmm. Homosexuality is an import from outside the country. It destroys or threatens Russian conservative values. And I think I've been thinking about this the last couple of days, and I really wonder if this also has the reason why gays are such a big issue, or has become a big issue for the Russian government, is there might be a kind of cultural crisis of masculinity, especially if you think of it in context of Putin's over hyper masculine performances. Right. And if you also think in the context of the demographic crisis, in the sense of men not being virile enough to reproduce the population.
Right.
So this could be kind of a indirect way or a kind of spasm of this kind of crisis that's going on in Russian society. This is just a theory I have.
No, that's certainly as good as any other theory I've heard on this, because it is mind-boggling. I mean, in its simplest terms, I mean, as I said earlier, it was part of this kind of what I call this culture war strategy. Mm-hmm. that Putin adopted after he lost the urbane part of society, after he lost the whatever you want to call it, creative class, rising middle class. When he lost that part, which was the bedrock of his support, they were looking for something. And this is what they came up with, making these populist working class appeals. And then the handmaiden of that is kind of the traditional cultural appeals. And part of that, and let's face it, we've seen this in the U.S. too. It wasn't that long ago when you could use this issue as a wedge issue in presidential elections. And one of our two political parties, I'm not going to say which, used to use it pretty effectively against the other political party until recently. And now it's come back to haunt them now. And it's actually working in the favor of the party that it used to work against. But I saw it as something that they were doing that. But I don't think they quite understood that by doing this, they were going to offend. I mean, let's face it, gays and lesbians are everywhere, right? I mean, they're in every society. And with the internet now and social networks, they're organized, and they're organized internationally, and their allies are organized with them. People who see this as part of general universal human rights, and they set off a firestorm here.
During the fact that it's become a cause célèbre, I mean, you know, as important these issues are. And this is something I don't understand why it creates so much passion, is because it is a cause célèbre in the West right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's if you're talking, Stephen Fry, we're talking big names getting involved in this thing. Daniel Savage, the creator of the It Gets Better campaign, was very active in this. And it's not just these laws. It's the signal that these laws sent to society. I mean, here at RFRL in recent weeks, we've done a series of stories about homophobic attacks that have been going on inside Russia. Groups with names like Occupy Pedophilia. Again, this strange conflation of homosexuality with something that is, it is a crime, and something that is not with something that is. These groups are entrapping young gay men online and then videotaping them being abused and posting these things on the internet. This also, went out on the internet, and not just homophobes saw it. People that have some conception of human rights saw these things, as well as the LGBT community. And this created as much outrage as the laws themselves, because those laws were passed a while ago. But the attacks which were broadcast online and spread like wildfire. I mean, once Savage and Fry got their hands on this thing, you're talking about people with millions of Twitter followers. I'm proud of my 3,000 followers, right? I mean, imagine having 6 million Twitter followers as Fry does. And to illustrate the how far this issue has come in the U.S. and in Western Europe in such a short time, in just a decade, and the different place that Russia is at on this issue right now, I want to play a clip. It's a little longer than the clips we usually play, but I want to play it anyway. It's President Barack Obama appearing on the Jay Leno on the Tonight Show with Jay Leno earlier this week. That appearance made news when Obama canceled his summit meeting with Putin, or hinted that he might cancel his summit meeting with Putin. That came the next day. But they also discussed the LGBT issue, and I want to play that clip and get you both to react to it. So let's listen.
Something that shocked me about Russia, and I'm surprised this is not a huge story. Suddenly, homosexuality is against the law. I mean, this seems like Germany. Let's round up the Jews. Let's round up the gays. Let's round up the black. I mean, it starts with that. You round up people who you don't want. I mean, why is not more of the world outraged at this?
Well, I've been very clear that when it comes to universal rights, when it comes to people's basic freedoms, that whether you are discriminating on the basis of race, religion, gender, or sexual orientation, you are violating the basic morality that I think should transcend every country. And I have no patience for countries that try to treat gays or lesbians or transgender persons in ways that intimidate them or are harmful to them. Now, what's happening in Russia is not unique. When I traveled to Africa, there were some countries that are doing a lot of good things for their people, you know, who we're working with and helping on development issues, but in some cases have persecuted gays and lesbians.
A couple of things jumped out at me here. First of all, as I said before, not long ago, I could not have imagined the president of the United States and the host of The Tonight Show, one of the most popular talk shows in the nation, having this discussion. I mean, really, Sean, could you imagine George H.W. Bush and Johnny Carson having this discussion? I couldn't imagine Clinton and Leno having this discussion. So that jumped out at me again, how fast, to the point where this is basically a settled issue. The president of the United States and one of the most visible and popular television personalities in the country are sitting here talking about this, like, what is wrong with these other countries that just don't see this? That, to me, was amazing, and it says how far we've come on this issue. The other thing that jumped out at me is that Obama essentially compared Russia to Africa on this issue. He was basically saying that Russia is not part of the developed world on issues like this. Leno, of course, compared Russia essentially to Nazi Germany, comparing homophobia to anti-Semitism. I was going to go to you first, Sean, but Kirill, you're indicating that you want to say something, so I'll let you jump in, because you obviously had something you wanted to say here. Kirill?
Two things. First of all, let's go back to Stephen Fry's letter. It's a very interesting document, very witty, very, you know, culturally based, historically based. He's a good writer, by the way. And he noticed a very important thing. We cannot compare Putin today with Hitler in 1939 or 1941. It's stupid, yes?
He compared them to him in 1936.
Yes, that's important. That's important. He found the weakest point of all this agenda. He wrote that when in 1936, the civilized world, or, you know, West, supported the idea of Berlin Olympic Games, he supported the move from authoritarian regime to totalitarian regime. The West supported the move from relatively mild persecution of Jews to Holocaust. That's very important. That was the beginning of this way. And that was a huge mistake by, you know, Western leaders and so on. Now, in Sochi, writes Stephen Fry, we have the same situation, because of course Putin is not Hitler, but if we support him at this point, he will go far and far and far in this direction, and that is the, you know, logic of any dictators, of any, you know, authoritarian leaders, which are going far, 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 far in this way. They can become totalitarian and so on. That's very important. That is a very serious, you know, in some sense, pedagogic lesson of his letter. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Secondly, just the same, what Barack Obama told about Africa. This is a very sensitive comparison to Russian
and
society.
And I think President Obama understood that.
Yes. And I love it because, you know, all this, you know, anecdotes and so on about, you know, what was Soviet Union, it's like Verkhnya Volta, upper Volta
with rockets,
with rockets and so on. That is the same point.
Yeah,
and that's very important.
But it was made by a let's face it, the first African American U.S. president.
Yes.
Nobody's going to accuse him of insulting Africa. Go ahead.
The only person who could speak about this in such terms is Barack Obama, and that is very, very, very witty. Yeah, I love it. Yeah, really, from the rhetoric point of view, it's very good. Yeah,
Sean, what was your reaction to the Obama Leno clip?
First, I took it as more for a domestic audience, first off, because this is a reaffirmation of the fact that, as you said, the gay rights issue now works in the Democratic Party's favor.
Right.
And Barack Obama's real contest is with the conservatives in the United States, and he's pushing an agenda right now about the economy, and he needs to. I mean, going on Jay Leno in and of itself is a way to get some public appeal and public support. So, at first I took it as this a very domestic performance, but secondly, I mean, the comparison to Africa is exactly an interesting one for all the things that Kirill said, because it does in a timeline of development, it's implicitly put Russia at the same level of development as Africa, and it is a way to swipe at Russia without really mentioning Russia.
I was wondering if that got any play in. I was looking through the Russian media to see if I don't know if Kirill, if you saw anything. I didn't, or if Sean, if you saw. I didn't see anything.
I think I have seen one commentary on this, just one on this. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead,
but I wanted to make a larger comment as to where this fits in the kind of the gay rights issue or the laws against the so-called anti-gay propaganda law fits in the cosmology of Putinism. And I wrote about this about over a month ago, and that I think this emphasis on conservatism, yes, it is a recent kind of move by Putin because he's trying to appeal to a different constituency of the provinces and the quote-unquote real Russian man. But I think if you consider Putinism as a process of reestablishing pillars of Russian statehood and society, the economy, the power, the state, power vertical, culture is the one of the last pillars.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've underestimated the conservatism of Putin and the system in Russia and how culturally conservative it is and how culturally conservative the Russian population is. Now, in terms of – we see a lot of references to polls that show that the majority of Russians are for these laws. And that's true, but I've also seen articles kind of breaking down these polls saying that most Russians – don't really care. It's kind of a personal issue. It's a personal choice issue. They just don't want to see it.
Right.
And a lot of the questions that are put in polls is more about the visibility of homosexuality as opposed to homosexuals.
But that's telling, because again, I remember when the polls in the West said the same thing.
And there's no doubt about it that Russian society on large is a homophobic society. And the fact that and as you rightly pointed out, the real danger here, I mean, the laws are bad enough because they're so vague and they're unwarranted and really have no justification. But the signal that it sends to radicals and extremists, particularly on the right in Russian society, is incredibly dangerous. I mean, last week we spoke about vigilantism.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, this is unleashed or given an implicit signal to vigilantes to take quote-unquote justice upon themselves. And this is where the government's play with these kind of populist measures gets out of their control.
Yeah.
And at some point, they're going to have to pull back the reins in some fashion, or they're going to lose control of the whole process.
Yeah, these groups, and it is. I mean, some of the stuff that the stories we put out last week on this were just pretty shocking. I mean, these groups claimed they were curing people of homosexuality, and they were forcing them to drink urine because that was the medicine.
And the context, I'm sorry to interrupt, but notice the context also with the migrant issue. Mm-hmm. The migrant issue, the government's attempt to deal with the problem in Moscow has unleashed nationalist groups that are going into markets and bashing up, non-Russians.
Right. Yeah. No, they may have created a monster they can't control here. On the question of public opinion, and this is something I'm wondering about, Kirill, you might be better equipped than anybody to shed some light on this. But one of the things that happened in the U.S., I'm very familiar with how the demographic change happened. And really, I mean, if you look at the 2004 election, the Republicans used the gay marriage issue as a wedge issue against the Democrats very successfully in that election, putting referendums on the ballot, remember, in different key states to get conservative voters to come to the polls on referendums on gay marriage or outlawing gay marriage in certain states. In 2008, the issue was basically a wash, and in 2012, it completely worked in the Democrats' favor. It was no longer dividing Democratic constituencies. In fact, it was uniting them. What happened between 2004 and 2012 in the United States? What basically happened was the millennial generation came of age politically. The millennial generation, those people who are now in their 30s, I would guess, or in their late 20s and 30s, came of age politically. A new voting bloc, a very large generation, entered the electorate. And this generation had very, very, very different attitudes about this issue than their parents. And so this is the change. It was basically a generational change that changed public opinion in the United States writ large. Do we see any evidence in Russia that the younger generation is in a different place than their parents on this issue, Kirill? I just don't know.
Of course, I'm not a specialist in demography, but I just can presume.
But you're a very well-read man.
thank you. I just can presume two things. First of all, birth rate in modern Russia is very poor. Mm-hmm. Yes, and that was so, you know, from the very end of 1980s, I think, the beginning of 1990s. Secondly, at the same time, life expectancy in Russia is also very low.
Right.
And combining to these facts, we can, you know, just presume that Russian society is middle-aged.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the answer from my point of view, that they are still, or is still, Russian society is still, in some sense, not just post-Soviet, and in some sense, and maybe in cultural sense, it's still Soviet. But another point is very interesting. When you compare, you know, American conservatives and traditionalists with the Russian ones, and the question of homosexuality, and so we must, you know, remember all the time that the foundation of all this, anti-homosexual, feelings and struggle in the United States, the basement is religion.
Mm-hmm.
That's very important.
In Russia?
That's no in Russia, because I am absolutely sure, and I absolutely agree with, Nikolai Mitrokhin and some other very good and very serious specialists in Russian, Orthodox Church, state of Orthodox Church now. They say that Orthodox Church is not such popular in Russia. We can, count even 5-7% of the population which we can name as a believers.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the being active.
Yes,
and going into
yes, things. Yes. Maybe less, maybe less. So I think this homophobia, which is quite popular in Russia, it based not on, some religious values or, church values and so on. It based on their Soviet experience. That's why I connected these two questions.
I think it's a combination, but you correctly paint the demographic picture. Russia demographically is being squeezed both at the life expectancy end and the birth rate end. That's true. But a new generation, and we've talked about it endlessly on this podcast, a new generation is rising. And I'm wondering, that has different attitudes than their parents in a lot of things, and it accounts for a lot of the energy we've seen in the protest movement. They are rising. The people that were born or came of age after the fall of the Soviet Union are a different lot than their parents on a lot of issues. I'm just wondering if there's any evidence that they're a different lot than their parents on this issue. Sean?
There doesn't seem to really be that much indication that there's a little bit more tolerance, true. I mean, the fact that you actually have a burgeoning gay rights movement in Russia is a testament of that, and it's mostly the providence of the young. But if you look at it in terms of, the political opposition in general, that is also composed of a lot of young people, they seem to not – there's a bit of distance between them and the gay rights issue,
mm-hmm,
right?
Yeah.
There's not an actual great embrace of LGBT issues. There's not a great embrace of the LGBT movement. I mean, I just read it. Dmitry Buikov, the citizen poet, wrote a column of last week, I think, where he was condemning Elena Muzilina over her, you know – cultural war, but he was quick to say that I'm no partisan, or I'm not in favor of the LGBT movement. So I think that they are kind of putting themselves at a distance on this.
Yeah, and it's not just – it's also the leaders. I saw
right.
The interview between Navalny and Ksenia Sobchak was very interesting on this question,
mm-hmm,
because she pushed him on this issue. And again, here, this is what I'm thinking. Ksenia Sobchak is of that generation, right? She pushed Navalny on this issue. If you're elected mayor of Moscow, in the unlikely event you're elected mayor of Moscow, would you allow gay parades in Moscow? And Navalny's answer was very, very telling, though. He was very legalistic. He said Article 31 of the Russian Constitution protects everybody's right to peacefully assemble.
Right.
And therefore, yes, I would support gay rights parades in Russia. But he was very, you know, clever in couching it in very legalistic terms and couching it in the Constitution, which is fine. But he didn't champion the moral aspect of this by any stretch of the imagination. He didn't want to touch that.
But to one of the points that Kirill said, and I disagree with him to some extent about this being a kind of still a Soviet culture. I mean, to some extent, I think he's right. But I think in terms of the cultural sphere of what post-Soviet Russia is about, there's still a lot of unanswered questions. I mean, what does it mean to – what is the kind of traditional culture of post-Soviet Russia? What is the traditional family of post-Soviet Russia? What is the traditional male of post-Soviet Russia? I think all of these questions have yet to be answered. And back to my earlier point that I think that the kind of launch of the emphasis on homosexuality – is an attempt to somehow define what it means to be those things in this context. I mean, one of the legacies – I mean, the collapse of the Soviet Union gave Russia a new economy, capitalism. It brought Russia into the global system. But it has yet to really give – and back to our discussion last week about what does it mean to be Russian.
Right, exactly.
And I think that this is part of that conversation.
Now, how big of a problem – do you see this turning into for Putin? I mean, we've seen the international reaction. We essentially see that. I mean, I tend to agree with you, Kirill. They don't really care what the West thinks. The attitude appears to be, you know, these gay rights things over those sissies in the West. In Russia, we're real men, you know, or something like that, or something. If I can possibly get inside their heads, I don't know if that's possible, but. Nevertheless, objectively, this could become a problem. Sochi could turn into a major embarrassment. How big of a problem do you see on the horizon, to both of you, whoever wants to jump in?
I think Sochi is a very vulnerable point for Putin in the nearest future, maybe the most vulnerable point. I mean, from absolutely two different sides. First of all, of course, it's corruption, and Russia just could be, you know, unprepared to the beginning of the games. And something, you know, I can't exclude this. Or something could happen just, you know, in the beginning of the opening ceremony. Mm-hmm. Something will collapse or something like this, yeah? And secondly, this new international wave of reaction against this homophobic legislation. And not just legislation. I am absolutely agree with you. It's not just a legislation. It's about attitude.
And the signals that
yes.
that legislation gave
yes.
To the most retrograde elements in society.
Yeah, because of course Stephen Fry, he is not, you know, the only one celebrity in the world and so on, but he is, by the way, extremely popular in Russia. Extremely popular in Russia. He played in Jeeves and Wooster series and Blackadder series, which are, you know,
and
very
he has
popular.
6 million Twitter
yes.
followers.
Yes, and all his books, by the way, are translated into Russian and widely read and so on. But most important is not just, you know, his own letter, but he began a sort of trend.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the difference between, you know, those who, including Stephen Fry, supported and still supporting Pussy Riot,
mm-hmm.
and those who are supporting LGBT rights. Because, of course, Pussy Riot trial and so on was, ridiculously, stupid and so on.
And we're going to talk about that next week at the anniversary,
yes,
by the way.
Yes, but anyway, they, in some sense, these girls, they did something criminal. In some sense.
They did something that would get a misdemeanor fine in most countries.
Yes, of course. I'm not speaking that...
I know you're not.
They were, you know, rightly accused and so on. But anyway, they did something, yeah?
Yeah.
Which is contradicted to, you know, the... Not just legislation, but, you know, the tradition, the, you know, whatever. At the same time, this attack against LGBT rights, they... which is absolutely unprovoked, first of all.
Yeah.
Secondly, which is, you know, as we told, just invented as one of the issues of modern Russian domestic politics. And thirdly, the most important thing, which is an attack against a universal Western,
right.
in some sense,
something,
law.
Something that's recognized
yes.
as a universal right
yes.
in the West, basically.
And... that's why I say that is a great difference between, you know, supporting Pussy Riot and supporting LGBT rights. Supporting Pussy Riot is a very good thing, but it's, you know, sort of, you know, you're still ad marginum, yes?
Yeah.
But here you are in the mainstream.
In the
and
West,
that,
for sure.
Yes,
in the West
and that
sure.
is the mainstream problem. And Putin never played with a, you know, serious mainstream international problem as a his domestic problem. And that is very...
Which makes me wonder, we're assuming he doesn't care. I'm just not sure he understood where the West was
yes,
in this.
Yes,
I'm just
that's
not
why,
sure about
that's
this.
Why, that's why...
Because we're going to start to see things. An Olympic boycott's tough, and I don't think it's going to happen. But I do expect some things to happen at the Olympics. I don't expect gay and lesbian athletes to come to Sochi and keep their mouths shut. For example, I just really don't expect that to happen.
Yeah.
We think of Jesse Owens at the Berlin game. I mean, just by going and performing. But this is a different case because, of course, yeah, Jesse Owens was an African-American and it was his appearance was enough. And winning gold medals was enough to make a statement. Expecting gay and lesbian athletes to make a statement. Sean, you want to jump in?
Yeah. Whether the gay and lesbian issue will become a problem for Putin, I think depends entirely on gays and lesbians in Russia. I won't even speak
that's
of transgender rights because that's not on the agenda.
That's not even on the agenda, yeah.
But in terms of – and I think this is exactly why the Sochi Olympic – the boycott of the Sochi Olympics is not politically a good idea because – the problem of gays and lesbians, as I understand it in Russia, is about appearance. I mean, if you think of – if there's anything to learn from the movement in the West, one of the early slogans is we're here, we're queer, get used to it. It's about making gays and lesbians a normal aspect
we
of
are
society.
Everywhere was the other.
Yeah, we are everywhere. We are your children. And this worked wonders in terms of the gay marriage issue. We are your children. We are your fathers and mothers. Mm-hmm. We are everywhere. Elena – Mizulina's son is gay.
Right.
Right? So the fact that I think gays and lesbian athletes in Sochi should make a statement mm-hmm. and should be there to make that statement to make gay and lesbian – gay homosexuality normative.
And if they do, this could advance this
absolutely.
Issue.
Absolutely.
And embarrass Putin at the same time.
And embarrass Putin as, because I think one of the means of – you know, we have a movement that's mostly kind of – liberal and building consensus and bringing gay and lesbian life into the normal, you know, throes of society, being able to show that we are one of you is incredibly important.
And another thing I'm wondering about that we're going to start, and we've already started to see artists, entertainers, musicians boycotting Russia over various issues, not just this issue. But once we start to see, I mean, if a Paul McCartney, for example, starts canceling concerts in Russia, somebody of that level, then you're also going to the rest of society is going to start to feel the pinch of being out of the mainstream on this. I mean, cultural boycotts also are quite powerful tools. Kirill, what do you think? We've discussed other cultural boycotts in this podcast in the past. Do you think that would be something effective, and do you see it as something that we might see?
In some sense, this boycott already began because, Bloodhound Gang.
I do not want to talk about Bloodhound Gang, who I did not even hear about before this.
already banned to
put a ban on any discussion of Bloodhound Gang on this podcast.
but speaking seriously, of course, it will and it should affect of, some... minds in Russia, if such figures like Paul McCartney or who else, I don't know.
Well, Madonna made a big statement.
Elton John, Madonna, or something. Yeah, I think that I'm still very skeptical about a wider Russian public opinion and so on. It's quite passive and so on. Okay, we will not see Sir Paul McCartney on Red Square. We'll see him on YouTube, or we just listen to Iosif Kobzon, and that's all. I think the real danger or the real problem for Putin and his regime will be from the inside, from the elite itself, which are absolutely sure that they are really bored with all this stupidity around all these things, because they just want to live to let them live their own life with all this money and so on, and just to run this country smoothly, and that's right. All without any this barbaric legislation and so on. Of course, all these people, all Russian elite is strongly connected to the West. They have apartments in London. They have children in United States, right, and so on. How they will still deal with all these things in the future, in the nearest 2-3 years? That is the problem. I think the most important danger for Putin is from inside the elite, from outside.
Well, this is, you hit on something important here, and it dovetails a bit with what I was saying about the rising generation, as small as it may be, but it's there, is that this is a globalized generation, and this is a globalized elite in a lot of ways. And I don't see how either of them, meaning the younger generation, who let's face it, I see them here in Prague all the time, having a good time in downtown and everything. They're a globalized, cosmopolitan generation. They're different from their parents in that way. And Sean?
Yeah, and I would like to add that the economic system is different, in the sense that one of the things that American corporations learned rather quickly is that gays and lesbians form a very powerful niche market.
Yes.
That you can market to.
Yeah.
And in a globalized economy that's more based on entertainment and kind of affective cultural productions, mm-hmm. this is a perfect market to tap into. Right. And I would imagine one other potential, if amongst the Russian elite, especially those who are kind of in the so-called new economy, high-tech entertainment business, this is what was in the United States, right? The big celebrity push was from the entertainment industry.
Yeah, that's where it started, yeah.
They're going to get, and I can't imagine, I'd be surprised if I'm not sick of it already, but all of these laws kind of work against the type of economy that even Russia needs to develop.
It's bad for business. And an anecdote that perfectly illustrates your point, Sean, is when Dan Savage called for the vodka boycott. If you remember correctly, he called for a boycott of two brands he named specifically: Ruski Standard, Russian Standard, of course, and Stolichnaya. Right? Immediately, I mean, I don't even think it was 24 hours past the CEO of Stolichnaya came out with a press release saying, hold on, we support LGBT rights. We support what Stephen Fry is doing. And by the way, we're not even Russian vodka. We're made in Latvia. Right. So, I mean, that to me really did illustrate it. I don't know if the CEO is sincere about supporting LGBT rights. They are a Russian vodka, although it is manufactured in Latvia. It's some of its production is in Latvia. And Stephen Fry did not accept. He continued to use the dump Stoli hashtag on Twitter on this. But that illustrates your point perfectly. And in a few moments, we're going to have to shift gears and look at another issue, the fallout of U.S. President Barack Obama's decision to cancel his summit meeting with President Vladimir Putin. I would like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me via Skype from London is co-host Kirill Coburn of RFERL's Russian service and a contributor to the online magazine Politru. And also on the all-important Skype line is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of the excellent Sean's Russia blog. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Barack Obama has canceled a scheduled meeting with Vladimir Putin.
It's a meeting
month.
With President of Russia, Vladimir Putin, and it was to be next
after
month.
After Russia decided to grant the NSA leaker Edward
Last
Snowden
time these two
asylum.
Got together, the body language spoke louder than their
the
words.
The Russians have sometimes reset. They've reset, all right, back
Cold
to
War
about
mentality that Vladimir Putin was still holding on to.
When the White House announced this week that President Obama was canceling his planned summit with Vladimir Putin in Moscow and, in fact, would not even meet him one-on-one on the sidelines of the G20 summit in St. Petersburg next week, the obituaries of the reset policy began rolling in, which leads to an obvious question to get the ball rolling. Was the reset, which was announced amid great fanfare when President Barack Obama came to office back in 2009, a failure? And since I have a strong opinion about this, I'm going to get us going by answering my own question. No, it was not. I am willing to argue that the reset, despite the bad state that Russian-American relations are in right now, was actually both a tactical and a strategic success. I don't expect either of you to agree with it, or maybe you will. We'll see. It was a tactical success because it actually achieved the very limited goals that it set for itself. As former State Department official Stephen Pfeiffer wrote in an op-ed this week, Obama wanted transit rights for U.S. military hardware to Afghanistan. He got it. He wanted Russian support in the U.N. Security Council for tougher sanctions on Iran. He got that, too. He wanted an arms control agreement, and he got that. The U.S. actually gave up very, very little to get these things. I mean, give me a break. Photo ops of Obama and Medvedev eating cheeseburgers together? I mean, really, what did the U.S. give to get these things? So if you look at it in a strictly tactical sense, I believe it was a success. Strategically, no, it didn't usher in a new era of Russian-American cooperation, but did we really expect it to? I didn't. What it did achieve, though, is something I think that's very enduring and very subtle. I would argue that by contributing to the overall thaw of the Medvedev presidency, the reset helped, and I stress helped, did not cause, was not the direct cause of, but helped contribute to the civic awakening we've been seeing in Russia over the past couple of years. In the wake of the reset, it became much harder to paint the opposition of tools of the State Department when the elite themselves were cozying up to them not so long ago. Remember all those sarcastic signs in the December 2011 protests? Hillary Clinton, where's my money? We all remember that. So that's my answer. I was watching as the obituaries of the reset came in, and I always looked at this as a tactical thing. We got a strategic benefit out of it at the end of the day, but no, it didn't transform Russian-American relations, but I never expected it to. Sean, what's your take? I saw you were tweeting about this a little bit today.
I should say that the foreign relations is probably my weakest point. So these are just – my comments will just be kind of impressions that I've gathered over the last couple of days. If Obama's reset limited itself to getting transit – corridor with Russia through to get Afghanistan or getting sanctions to Iran. It, to have such an instrumental policy towards Russia, I think, is a major testament to how the Obama administration lacks any strategic vision toward Russia. I mean, Russia is a major country, a major power in the world. And for Obama, the Obama administration to not understand and not have a strategic policy as part of the reset, I think shows a major failure. Now, I'm not so sure if it helped the civic awakening, as you suggest. I don't see how cozying up with the West. I mean, Russia's foreign policy is highly, highly realist. They're cozy up when they need to, and they'll pull back when they don't see it in their interests. And what's interesting about what's happened about the cancellation of the meeting with Putin is everyone seems to agree that the meeting was about nothing.
Right.
So it was kind of like no one's going to really lose anything. If anything, it was a symbolic gesture and kind of gave a temperature check at the state of Russian-American relations at this point. But the big problem is that on major issues, that the United States needs Russia more than Russia needs the United States, by the way, on Syria, for example, There's no movement, and there doesn't look like there's going to be any movement. And this is where I think this is the problem with lacking any kind of strategic vision on the part of the Americans, and not really understanding the way Putin operates in foreign policy.
I would argue there was a strategic vision. If you look at the concrete deliverables of what the administration wanted to get out of the reset. I mean, I remember reporting on this when it first was happening, and what you heard again and again from you know, and I'd say, what concretely do you want right now out of the Russians? And those three things were what they always mentioned: transit rights, Russian help on a UN resolution increasing sanctions against Iran, and an arms control agreement. That's what they wanted in the short term. In the long term. And people like Michael McFaul, who was the architect of Obama's Russia policy, were talking about these engaging the whole society, resetting relations with society. And I think that was a success. I mean, you're right. Russians are realists and they cozy up when it suits their interests and they back off. But to have this brief period, however brief it was, in which the U.S. wasn't being demonized in the media. I mean, I remember on Obama's birthday, and I believe it was 2010, there was a music video wishing him a happy birthday on Russian state television. I mean, I had never seen that kind of a thing for a U.S. president. When you're doing stuff like that for a couple of years, right? If you say the reset started when Obama came to office in January 2009, and I guess you can say it ended when Putin came back to the Kremlin in what, May of last year. So it lasted a couple of years. To have this, the U.S. painted in a completely different light, where it wasn't so bad to be friends with America. That changed the vibe in society a little bit. And I don't want to underestimate the when I saw those signs of the demonstrations joking around saying Hillary Clinton, where's my money? Basically making fun of the Kremlin, saying you're all White House stooges, you're all State Department stooges. Ksenia Sobchak having that briefly lived television program called Gosdep, State Department. This tells me that people are looking at this, they kind of look at this with a bit of irony. Kirill, what do you think of all this?
My opinion is very pragmatic and down to earth.
I think nothing else from you.
Yes, I think that so-called reset was a sort of marriage of two real politics, of real politic of world power and real politic of semi-autocratic former empire. The pragmatism of two of these two sides is very different, and both of them had their own tasks and aims, and they succeeded, mm-hmm. both of them, in this reset policy, because I'm absolutely agree with you when you're speaking about all this international gains of US foreign policy and so on. Of course I agree. At the same time, Putin had a lot of domestic things which he gained, and I think Obama failed during this period. He very witty produced an impression that reset is all about, that we can speak about United States, all the things which we want, Putin himself and all, you know, state TV and so on, and at the same time, and we will you know, receive nothing from the United States, no any, you know, supplier.
Well, but during the reset, though, when Medvedev was president, these propaganda shows smearing the United States, they weren't happening. These things came back into fashion when Putin came back. The reset worked as long as Medvedev was in the big chair. And I don't think they would have attempted it with Putin in the big chair, to be honest.
Anyway, Putin, he's, you know, on his third presidential term already, you know, more than one year, yeah? And don't forget all these events around, you know, just introducing Michael McFaul in Moscow and all, you know, these attacks on him and so on. That is a normal state of, you know, friendly relationships between two countries. But I think the aim of Putin propaganda was to show its own population or its own citizens that we can do with these Americans all we want to do. And that is the real meaning of this reset policy. And I think that that was a very important victory of, in some sense, and of Putin, but just on his domestic front, because the interests of both countries are in the absolutely different fields. That's why we can speak that reset.
And that would be the case even if we had the friendliest of relations, quite frankly. That would be the case even if we had the friendliest of relations. I mean, two countries this big are going to bump into each other. They're going to have conflicting interests. It's going to happen. So that doesn't preclude. And what the reset said was basically, all right, we're going to find these areas where we can work together, where we have common interests, and we're going to de-emphasize, not ignore, not deal with, but de-emphasize the areas of where we have conflict. I think that worked fine, again, as long as Medvedev was in the big chair. I think the administration was counting on maybe Medvedev staying in the big chair a little bit longer. And that may have been a miscalculation. Let's face it, Sean, so are you and I. because we were both, if we go back to what the both of us were writing back in those days, we thought, because it looked logical. And let's face it, there were people in the Russian elite that were trying to get that. And we weren't getting that out of nowhere. We were basically, this is what Surikov and Pavlovsky and others who were, you know, in positions of power at the time were pushing for. So it wasn't an outlandish idea to think that the tandem arrangement might continue. And that more gains might be made. I would also take issue with I think the U.S. needs a lot from Russia, but I don't think we're in a position where Russia needs nothing from the United States. And Steve Pfeiffer made this point in his what I thought was an excellent op-ed in the Moscow Times this week. If Russia ever decides that it wants to get serious about modernizing its economy, and I know maybe I'm talking like it's a science, maybe that's a science fiction novel right now, but they really do need to get serious about this objectively. They are going to need the U.S. Medvedev realized this. Surikov realized this at the time, which is why they were, you know, trying to create things like Skolkovo, which is, you know, something we never talk about anymore. But these things were not just white elephant projects. They were happening for a reason, because smart people in the Russian elite realized that they did have to modernize this economy. And that need has not gone away just because they've decided they don't want to pay attention to it anymore. Sean, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I think despite all these things and this tit for tat that has really begun since the Magnitsky Act, you know, Russia and the United States will continue to work on the things that they have mutual interest: international terrorism, international drug trade. All of these they'll certainly, I think, continue to work about Iran. Syria is a different question. So on those mutual interests, I think, regardless of how kind of cold the relations seem on the surface, I think behind the scenes they'll continue to do these things without question. But does Russia really need the United States to modernize the country? They have the European Union on its western border, and they have China on its eastern border. The United States, in terms of global, I wonder how, in terms of markets, let's say, the United States doesn't function really that big as a market for Russia. And
it
I
could.
Think you get a, it could, but it doesn't have to. And in terms of any kind of technological modernization,
no,
it has two to technologically advanced societies on.
Well, I would argue it needs the West writ large, which the U.S. is a big player.
Right, but the United States—that may be true. But it's interesting that the European Union is not part of this conversation in terms of relations. The European Union is hamstrung by Russia because it needs gas.
Right.
They're not. I don't think they're going to make major foreign policy problems with Russia because of the gas issue.
As long as they remain dependent on Russian gas, but I would still argue that they need to be careful about isolating themselves too much right. from the West writ large, and the U.S. is a big part of that.
But I think that there's two issues the way I understand the problems for Russia U.S. relations. First one is Putin,
and the second really one's Putin.
First one is Putin, and it really does show. During Medvedev's president, a lot of people were talking about how, he was just a puppet, Putin was in charge, et cetera, and there's elements of truth to that. But the difference between these two periods are so stark.
That's
now.
Amazing.
It makes me wonder, maybe we overstressed that Putin is really doing a lot behind the scenes here.
Yeah, no, I've that thought's crossed my mind as well. I mean, if you look at one of the areas of open disagreement between mm-hmm. Medvedev and Putin was Libya.
It's Libya,
and Medvedev acquiesced to what the West wanted on Libya, and Putin was not happy about that.
So all of the real changes in the kind of the end of the reset was being spoken about the minute Putin came back to power.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Then that there's been a kind of domino effect of tit-a-tat over a variety of issues. The second problem, I think, in U.S.-Russian relations is that Obama seems to be allowing Congress – and the media to determine the course. For example, Obama, it seems, did not want the Magnitsky Act.
Right.
He did not want to sign it, but he was pressured to sign it because the overwhelming senators and House representatives voted for
it. Including his own party.
Including his own party. He was hamstrung by American domestic politics. He's getting pressure from the Republicans that he's too soft on Russia.
As all Democratic presidents
do. Democratic – exactly. And so – and then also around the Snowden thing, the uproar in the media and the uproar in amongst the congressmen was just – it kind of put – if Snowden put Putin and Russia in a corner, I think the American media and the American Congress put to some extent Obama in a corner.
Yeah.
And this is one of the issues I think that in terms – I mean, I'm not trying to blame the Obama administration. Don't get me wrong. I mean, they're in a very difficult position in dealing with Putin in Russia. He's complete – Putin is immovable on many –
No,
on
he's
many,
undealable with him.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's more realist than realist.
Right.
But at the same time, by not having a kind of grand strategic vision as to how they're going to approach Russia in a larger sense – they've allowed the relations to be hijacked to some extent by other forces.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm not sure what that grand strategic vision can be given the
Neither
state of
I.
affairs right now. I mean, and in terms – I think – I mean, the reset ended with the castling. The reset ended in September 2011.
Absolutely.
It ended with the castling. But something else began with the castling, and that's this new period, this turbulent period we find Russia in right now that really could – put an end to this political period in Russia, possibly. We still don't know how this chapter is going to end. So, and I still would stick by my assertion that this civic awakening that we began to, that we saw the seeds of during the Medvedev presidency, and I would argue the reset helped water those seeds, if not plant them, that this civic awakening is the most important outcome of that whole period, of the period of the interim Medvedev presidency, of the tandem and the reset. These all things were closely linked to each other. We're running out of time here. Kirill, you wanted to say something. You have the last word before
Wow, last word. Okay. The most problem, I think, in bilateral relations between the United States and Russia is common delusion about the level of these relationships. Both leaders or both, elites still think about these relations as relations between two great powers. That's not true. That's not true. They're still thinking about these relations in the terms of, Cold War, not just as a, struggle between two great powers, just dealings between two powers.
Right. Even they're using the word summit to describe the meeting between the presidents. When we meet the president, the chancellor of Germany, it's not a summit. It's just...
Yes. In reality, Russia is just one of many other countries, and that's all. And the lack of strategy, Obama's strategy towards Russia, I absolutely agree with Sean in this case, is the result of this. Because if you are dealing with the great power which is, you know, on the same level as you, you must be pragmatic. That's why United States, they are very cautious in their dealings with China, say, because of, you know, China is a great power. Yes, it's a great economy and so on. In the case of Russia, United States could be, you know, more, I'm sorry for this word, but more romantic, not pragmatic, because Russia is not such important. Mm-hmm. You can be not such pragmatic. You don't need, you know, so many things from Russia. United States not in the they're not in the position of European Union because of you know, this gas addiction and so on. United States they can play much more free game against or, you know, towards Russia. And I think that is the main problem of all, you know, Obama administration in its dealings with Moscow. They must think more, you know, courageously, maybe.
Well, this relation's never been recalibrated.
Absolutely.
After the Cold War. It's never been recalibrated into what is this relationship anymore. Is it a relationship just like a relationship we have with Germany or France or I don't know, Brazil? Or is it it's not clear what place it is in the constellation of U.S. relations. So I think
I'm not giving, you know, any advices for especially for Obama administration. But I think the first thing they terribly need to do to rethink everything. The charms, their words, their, you know, rhetoric and so on. They're all, you know, the whole level of all these relations. And then act much feeling, yeah.
Maybe this will be the beginning of that. And that, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me via Skype from London has been co-host Kirill Coburn of RFERL's Russian service and a contributor to the online magazine Politru. And also on the Skype line has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of the must-read Sean's Russia blog. Thanks, as always, for the great discussion, guys.
My pleasure.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant and astonishingly patient producer, Tanya Konchova, who I hope never puts my outtakes on the internet. I'd also like to thank my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week when we'll discuss the one-year anniversary of the Pussy Riot verdict. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.